back, session number 23153, reel 3.
But I didn't like it at all.
No.
You can imagine how uncomfortable having somebody...
Was the observer in charge of navigation as well? And normally that was so, wasn't it?
Well, it would be, yes.
So, but you had to rely on your own navigation?
Oh, yes.
This chap?
I did rely on it, as a matter of fact.
Yeah. But, I mean, from what Insull says in his book, the observer actually did all the navigating as such.
Yes.
Now, there was one other thing you brought up. You related how, when you were at Netherhaven, you used to go cloud chasing.
Oh, yes. Ah, but that is because I was given the job of going up. Dawes said to me, look, I got my wings by that time. And he said, take your machine up and stay up for 3 hours. When you come down, don't have anything done to it. No plugs changed or any single thing. Nothing. And see that the mechanics do that. Nothing. And then go up again tomorrow, another 3 hours. Same thing. And the third day. This was done. And that's the time when I went cloud chasing. I chased clouds all over the place. I could see the Isle of Wight on. That's one thing I used to use me. I said, wonderful what you can see from 6,000 or 7,000 feet.
You see the whole island in one piece?
Oh, no, well, I wouldn't say that. I see the little patch of sea in the island. But it is very useful. It is very handy. This cloud, going into the clouds and coming out again, still keeping us straight, you see.
Yes.
Because it came in handy a few months later.
Could you feel, how did you feel? Could you feel the air on your cheek or something when it went off sideways, or just the, did you just feel it in your body? Equilibrium was wrong.
I don't think we had any gadgets.
But you had an inclinometer, I suppose.
I don't think we had one.
No.
At that time. Well, I think you could always feel that you were side-slipping or doing anything of that kind.
Yes, you feel the air pressure.
Yes. But it came in, I think, did I tell you the story of myself and an observer? We had a very dull, uninteresting, it was in September 15.
Yes.
Patrol. Saw nothing, did nothing. Everything was a washout, you see. So going home, I saw at about 6,000, I saw an enormous cloud ahead of me. Gigantic thing. It seemed to extend to 20,000, probably did. So I thought, I wonder what it's like inside that. I'd had some nice easy ones at Netherhaven. I said, well, this one looks fierce. It was. I don't know what the observer was thinking all this time, but I went in and the effect of going in, I couldn't see a damn thing. It was black as pitch.
Did you have to go in it?
No.
Or did you go in it?
I went in on purpose.
Oh.
For amusement. It wasn't amusing at all. This time, it was not amusing. Because what I was doing was this. I couldn't see a single thing, and I was pulling the stick back. Anything quite good, because I didn't want to go diving into something. And I thought I'd better keep it steady. But what I was doing was stalling, you see.
Yes.
I stalled it. And the machine suddenly did peculiar things that I didn't like the feel of at all. I was spinning, you see. Now, spinning was, at that time, was you were a dead man.
This was your first spin, was it?
Yes, it certainly was. And last unintentional spin. I learned how to spin afterwards, but this was unintentional. But I was highly amused at myself by the fact that I got out of the spin as I came out of the cloud, you see. I was very pleased with that. I was in the dive that always takes place after the end of the spin business,
yeah,
when you're doing it. And I must have corrected it inside the cloud, you see, at last. But how I corrected it was a mystery to me. I didn't know, unfortunately. but the whole thing was an icicle.
Robin, the passenger must have taken rather a bore view of the whole thing.
No, well, he said to me, I was very interested in the whole thing because the whole thing was in ice, dripping from every spar, every wing. And I said, what do you think of that? Let's take it home. I want to take it down to 11th Squadron at Vertangles and see.
You could
ask
see
them what
the
they think.
Icicles streaming off, could you?
What?
There were icicles hanging off.
Oh, yes. I got into what you call a wet cloud, I suppose.
Yes.
Very wet one. And the spin had produced the ice. It was September, you see. It wasn't cold, really, on the ground.
No.
But in the air. Now, the next thing was that I couldn't operate the pump to push the, you know, it stopped.
The fuel pump.
The fuel pump.
Yes.
It was 1.25 pounds or something, it had to be. It was frozen, that's why. So I said to the observer, who just observed to me, he said, that was some swirl we got into. It was the first time I saw the comic side of the whole thing.
Yes,
some swirl, yes, we were spinning like tops. So I said, well, look out for a decent landing ground because the engine won't start.
Yes.
But the warm air, as we went on down, a couple of 1,000 feet or 3,000 feet lower, the warm air melted the whole bag of tricks, so I couldn't show them at 11th Squadron what a Vickers fighter looked like when it was frozen stiff.
With icicles pouring down.
And I was able to get, suddenly the pump started to work, and I was able to pump it up and start the propeller, and off we went. Nothing happened, nothing else. But it was the most interesting thing I think I remember doing up to that time.
Now, all these patrols that you did with the 11th Squadron, they were all single aircraft patrols.
Yes.
They never had any...
One could come up, the other go down.
Yes, so there was never two or three or any groups at all, just single.
Single.
Yeah.
Same in DH2 until flying started, or rather the
formation. Yeah. Now, you were at Vertangles with the 11th Squadron.
Yes.
Now, of course, when you went back to 24th Squadron, you probably knew your way around quite well.
Well, I did.
But, of course, the 11th Squadron was based on the other side of the railway tracks, wasn't it?
That's right.
And there was a sort of railway cutting in between.
Yes,
that's it.
And 11th Squadron had, 24th Squadron had, not the older squadron, 11th, they were naturally, wherever they were posted. This was a new lot of huts.
What,
on the other
squadron?
Side, 24.
So it was a new
area. But it was still Bertang.
It was still Bertang. And, of course, the 11th Squadron was nearer the village. On that side of the tracks?
Well, you could walk down to the village or drive down from the aerodrome on the 24 side. But in the 11th Squadron, I was actually deposited in Bertang.
Yes, you were posted there,
right? I was billeted inside the village.
In the village, yes.
In 24 Squadron, we were billeted in the village too.
Yes.
At first.
Yes.
During the winter. But as soon as summer started, we cut out places in the woods, in little they put Nissen huts and things.
I see,
And I could have my bath and everything else in the woods.
Right, well, I think that more or less sort of finishes the 11th Squadron side of things. Now, you went back to England in... December 1915 from 11th Squadron?
Yes. I think about the 7th.
Yes. And then you had some leave, I presume?
Yes.
After that. Now, and then you went on to 24th Squadron at Helmsford.
Right.
Right. And what aircraft did they have there? They had the Vickers fighter there, didn't they?
They did have one or two.
I think in the official...
It was a sort of melange of all kinds of things. They had they had an Avro, a 50 Avro.
Yes. Very early one.
An early one, yes.
And it had some Martin-sized cauldrons.
Hawker gave me... I said, have you flown an Avro? I said, never. He said, well, come along, let's have a journey. Because I had to fly it at night. Because it was looking after Zeppelins as well, you see, 24th Squadron at that time.
Yes.
At various farms in the district and at 24th. end of town.
What is that, farm, say like Sutton's farm?
That's it, Hainold's farm, Sutton's farm. Yes.
It wasn't until January 1916 that you got the first DH2s.
Yes, about middle of January. Yes. About 3 weeks before we went out. Yes. And nobody had flown it more than, say, an hour and a half.
And what did you
think? That alone is an extraordinary state of affairs, isn't it?
Yes, it's true, yes.
Nobody knew the DH2. Oh. I think I've got on my thing, tried a new machine today, DH2 or something.
Yes. Now, what do you think of the DH2 compared to other airplanes?
I thought it was quite a simple machine to fly.
You didn't have any particular trouble with it?
No. The only trouble was cylinders. I had lots of trouble with those.
Later on.
On two occasions.
Yes. But did you, I'm talking about initially, you know, when you first flew the aircraft, say in January or February. Well, it must have been in January, actually.
January, yes.
Did you find that it was similar to the Sutton's Camel? In a way, you know, from the point of view of the torque effect?
Oh, no. The difference between that and the Camel was enormous. It is a much more powerful engine. It was 130 horsepower Clerget, the one I dealt with. And it is quite a different kettle of fish, the Camel. In fact, it used to trouble its people learning to fly on it. It used to kill themselves rather more frequently than they should have done. Because, I think, I never had any trouble the first time I flew one, but then I'd been through Smith Barry School of Special Flying by the time that happened.
Well, anyway, we'll talk about that a bit later. But
this is the point. On the ground, taking off, you had to be as rough as you jolly well could with your stick.
With the
DH2? With the other thing, the Camel.
With the Camel, yes. Yeah.
The instant you were in the air, you had to be as delicate as little Mary, you see.
Yes, yes, right.
And if you weren't, you were in trouble right away. The usual sort of thing to see a pilot flying a Camel for the first time usually used to go along like that, and then suddenly he'd swerve off the line because he was being weak with it instead of being tough, saying, "You go the way I want you."
Yeah.
And the thing would be to go onto its head and onto its neck and turn over. Yeah. Not very good, very annoying.
Getting back to the DH2, you said in your logbook you put tricky.
Tricky, did I?
Next to it. So I presume that there was something there which made it a little bit more lively. It's
very different to the old thing that I'd had in France.
Because fighter, yes.
Because that was very slow and sloppy, you see.
Yes.
This thing did go at least 80 miles an hour.
And it was sensitive, on controls.
Yes.
Was there any particular trouble with handling that on the ground at all, the DH2?
It what?
Was there trouble with the ground handling?
The ground?
Handling. I mean, you know...
You mean taxiing about?
Taxiing, yes.
No, none. I don't
know. None at all.
No.
Because, you know, I've read elsewhere that a lot of people have trouble, say, in gusty weather, in keeping the aircraft straight, you know, when taking off, and you find that the wingtip would graze the ground.
Yes.
Then you get a ground something like that.
Well, I can only remember that the day we took off on the 7th of February, Cowan, who was a very good pilot, too, especially of the DH2, which is the only one I knew him on about, was that very day, he turned over on his back. It was some days before he got out, got back to the squadron. And several other things happened to him. The only flight that got there was B flight.
Very bad weather conditions.
But even then, Tidmarsh just bumped his nose. But that was only just a little hammering and so on to fix that up.
Yes.
We crossed the channel in 12 minutes, I think I said.
Yeah.
There's a strong wind behind us, you see.
Yeah, it's very good, I suppose. But it got a bad name at the DH2 later on, didn't it?
It was called the flying incinerator or something
like that.
Yeah,
spinning incinerator, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Spinning incinerator.
Spinning incinerator, yeah.
Yes.
But that was, I think,
earth, but due to bad destruction?
Probably.
Because apparently the bad...
You had to teach yourself to fly in those days.
Yes.
I didn't know anything about flying, although I had a wonderful reputation when I left Brooklands because of this right-hand turn business. That made everybody think I was a super pilot.
Your whole reputation based on
nothing.
Based on a mistake.
Yes.
What was supposed to be.
It was nothing. I was a very bad pilot, in my own opinion, you see, at the time when they were saying, but I didn't say, no, you're talking utter nonsense,
I
mean, Simon.
Really learning anyway.
But obviously, the reason that you were made a flight commander in 24 Squadron was because of your experience with rotary engines and with the Pickles fighter.
Yes.
You know, because you've been in a fighting unit.
Yes.
And also, you've got some experience of a Monosopathic.
Yes.
So I should imagine that going to a DH2, you would have less trouble than somebody else because you knew what the Monosopathic would do.
Yes, that's so.
I mean, obviously, and so did Hawker. Hawker had experience of rotary engine aircraft as well.
Yes.
Obviously, when he flew the DH2, he knew what was likely to happen if you weren't careful due to torque for the engine. Mm. But I should imagine lots of the newer pilots, which joined straight from the training units, they've been flying Morris Farmers and Henry Farmers, which were very docile aircraft, weren't they?
It was the Henry Farman I used to instruct on at 24 Squad.
Yes.
That was my job.
Yes. And you say that you didn't receive all your DH2s until the last minute, really.
Yes, that's right.
So you didn't have enough time to train the pilots to fly.
No.
And also, I think Tyrrell Hawker says in his book that the engines were unreliable because they were the throwouts, more or less, reconditioned French engines.
I think so.
And you were told not to fly them very much because you would never get across the channel if you flew them too much.
The other, going back a little to the 11th Squadron business, my trip to France to join it was a peculiar one. Quite different to anybody else's, I think. Because this is what happened. I was on weekend leave. When I got back on, Sunday, no, I think I took the milk train or something, the last train you could take, early, first train you could take, I should say.
Yeah.
And I found the squadron had gone. I said, what's happened to it? I said, they've gone to France. What do you mean? Why aren't you there? I said, I've just come back from leave. Oh, well, there's a note for you, I believe, somewhere.
Oh.
And, The note said that Pattinson, who had just been sent to the squadron, and he was in the same flight as I was. I'm 11th Squadron, yes, that's right. Same flight, C flight. And he'd taken my machine and flown it across to France. And they said, his machine, which is now your machine, is a new one at Farnborough. Go and collect it, bring it back and have it fitted up, whatever it was wanted fitting up. So I went to Farnborough. I returned to Netheravon, and they said, all right, well, you won't be able to take this away today, you know. I said, why not? He said, we've got to put the roundels on. I said, I see, but what's that won't take long. Oh, they said, to dry properly, the castor oil would very soon remove the whole lot, so you'd be just a smeary mess, no roundels. I said, very well. I stop at Netheravon tonight then. Yes. Now the next day, it was still not right, so I didn't get away till late in the afternoon, and I was told to go to Hastings. To a place called nearby Hastings, just outside. Sure. Anyhow, there was a RFC aerodrome there. Got it in my book here if I look at it.
Yeah.
And said, well, when we... I had, that's where Donald, he was left behind for me. He was my engine man, you see. I had to fly him over. And we started for Hastings, or that place nearby. And I noticed that it was getting a bit dark. The month was July, about the 26th or something. And I thought, well, now, there's a girl in Hastings that I know. I'll give her a surprise. But if I fly just around here for a little bit longer...
Who's that girl?
Dorothy Swaby.
Dorothy Swaby.
And... it's looking very dark now. I don't think they'll want me to go on to get into town, you see. And this is what happened. But there's one other thing. They supplied you with leather trousers, a leather flying jacket in those days. I only wore the trousers once. That was the time when I flew to Hastings. And just as well I did, because there was an oil thing in front of me, a glass tube, you know.
Oh, yes,
it was pulsating.
Yes.
Well, that had a leak in it. It was pouring all over these leather trousers, which saved my uniform anyhow. So when the flight commander rolled up when I landed, he said, you're a bit late. You are going to France, aren't you? I said, yes, that's the idea. But it is a bit late. And besides this, look at my trousers. This oil wants to be fixed up. He looked and he saw, and as Robbie's song said, and he listened. And he said, yes, you won't be able to go tonight. Besides, there's two or three more I have to see off. You're too late now. I said, what a pity. I said, have you got a tent for going into Hastings? Because I want to stay at the something hotel, Burlington Hotel. And he said, yes, there will be. I said, fine. And off I went to Hastings. Now, I knew that Dorothy Swaby was, I'd got her out of a, she was in the Middlesex Hospital, you see, as a nurse. But it wasn't her normal state of affairs, being a nurse. This is a perfectly ordinary war job. She came from Barbados, where her father was the Bishop of Barbados, you see. And she decided to join the war in that way. And she went to Middlesex Hospital. And sometime early on, when I was at Netheravon, she wrote and said she was done nothing but scrub floors for the last 3 months or something. And she said, I can't cope with all this. And I'd like to get to my aunt's at Folkestone. Did I say Hastings?
Yeah, you said Hastings. I've
been talking about Hastings. It wasn't Hastings, it was just Folkestone.
Yes, yes.
Lim was the name of the aunt.
Lim. Yes.
Lim. Near Folkestone.
Yes.
I always mix those up.
Yes.
Anyhow, her hospital was quite close to this hotel, Burlington, at Folkestone. So I popped across to the hotel, got a room for the night, and I said, is Swaby about anywhere? I said, yes, she is. Here she comes, or something. I said, hello, Dorothy. You know, I said, here I am at Lynn up there. I see that in the book here, there's the, what's that musical comedy? A very good one, anyway, those days. Was on at the theatre. I said, you'd like to come to the theatre, and we can have some dinner at the hotel. She said, snap, so off we went to the theatre, you see. I dropped her at her home with her aunt. She lived around, her aunt's down there. And I went to bye-byes at the hotel. The next morning, up to the aerodrome again. But I said to her the night before, I said, look, can you manage to get off? We'll taxi up, you can see me fly away. She thought that was a jolly good idea. So did the taxi driver, because he was very interested in watching this performance. It was still rather rare, you see, this sort of thing. And I had to see about something, and Donald was telling her, pulling a long line to her about something, to the effect that I was a marvellous pilot or something. I don't know, but we started off for France. But I said, we'll go up to 6,000 feet, because I don't want to sit down in the sea if anything goes wrong. So we'll have a 6-mile glide, which is about what you can do on per 1,000 feet, you see. And just as well, something went very radically wrong. Something threw out, I don't know what, wrong, connecting rod or something. Anyhow, down I came again, to the annoyance of this flight commander who wanted to see me gone, you see. I said, there isn't a chance of that. There's something radically wrong with the engine. My engine man will soon be on the job. If you've got some more, it perhaps would be a good idea. He said, I said, in the meantime, I'll go into Hawking and go into Hastings once more. And not Hastings, Folkestone.
Yeah.
And again, and I said, I haven't gone, you see. You saw me off, but I didn't get very far.
Yeah.
And I explained the story. And I said, I don't know whether there's anything good on for tonight at the theatre, but we might see it if it is. But at any rate, that was really, the flight commander said, look, the engine was all right by the time evening stepped in. And he said, tomorrow morning, I want you here at 7 o'clock, and I'll send a tender to catch you, wind you up. So I said, yes, that's fine. And that's how I went to France. The next day I went over in 18 minutes, across the channel in 18 minutes.
No trouble.
18 minutes to cross the channel.
But a year later I did it in 12 on a DH2.
Yeah.
But then I had a gale behind me.
Yeah. How long is colossal things that take people?
Concords and things?
Yes, how long do they take?
Oh, about 2 minutes actually.
A couple of minutes.
Here's Dover, here's Folkestone.
No, I mean, joking apart, how long?
Well, it would do with a supersonic aeroplane, but the thing is, it probably takes
you
2 hours.
Well, these passengers, they
yes, this is a passenger.
It takes 2 hours to go from Rome, I know that, in an aeroplane. That's getting off 900 miles, London, Rome.
Yeah.
Over 900 miles, I think.
And you say that they cross the channel in a few minutes.
They do, but of course, you've got to land somewhere, which takes a bit longer. And then, of course, it'll take you a couple of hours to get from the airport to the city centre.
Yeah.
It always takes longer to go from the
city centre. Well, I think it drives either way.
You know, it takes nearly as long to go from the centre of London to Heathrow Airport. And by the time you finish going through the customs and all the paraphernalia and formalities, you get on the aeroplane, right? The trip to, say, Rome or somewhere like that takes less.
I want to know is from coast to coast, how long?
So it would take you more than a couple of minutes.
Really?
Yeah, because I mean, you're flying, say, at about, 600 miles an hour, 700 miles an hour?
Hopefully.
And you cover that amount of time.
Well, is it the short crossing, so to speak, that you're talking about, or anywhere? It gets much wider.
Yes, but it's the shortest is about 20 miles, 21, I think.
And that takes a long time by boat. I think it takes about over 2 hours by boat, normally, even the shortest.
Yes, but now for flying Dover to Calais,
I think if you flew, I think you fly from, was it Lip, I think, to Le Bourget. I think it takes you approximately, I think it takes about 18 minutes, the same as it did with the Spicer. In an ordinary aeroplane of today.
Yes.
It's probably taking the same amount of time. But I mean, you're talking about from coast to coast, but normally, when you talk about flying across the channel, you're talking about the time taken to take off from the airport to land at the airport. You see, but of course, the airports are quite a long way inland.
Yeah.
Aren't they? A few miles, anyway.
Yeah, some of them, yeah.
But actually, over the patch of water,
they're probably...